Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who explains why he believes government dragnet surveillance and the massive collection of personal data threaten to undermine civil liberties, privacy rights, and democracy itself. Robert Hillary King, who talks about how he survived 31 years in prison, 29 of which were spent in solitary confinement at Louisiana's Angola State Penitentiary for a crime he didn't commit. And Drew Hudson, Executive Director of Environmental Action, who discusses his group's campaign urging National Public Radio to stop taking corporate sponsorship funding from the natural gas fracking industry. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A decade after pop stars Bob Geldof and Bono helped convince rich Western countries to slash the massive debt owed by poor African nations, these countries' debt ratios, fueled by a boom in natural resources, are once again rising. As foreign aid funds dwindled and prices for commodity products surged, nations like Ghana prospered and went to private capital markets to borrow funds to build new infrastructure. According to Reuters, other formerly indebted nations quickly followed, including Senegal, Nigeria, Zambia, and Rwanda. Through the World Bank's debt relief program, 30 low-income African countries wrote off over $100 billion in debt. Now, private borrowing has increased to the point that a new rising debt crisis is looming. Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz observed, "The financial sector loves to find people to prey on, and their most recent prey is governments of developing countries. They get indebted, they get a bailout from the World Bank and the IMF, and they start over." Stiglitz says, "Memory is short and greed is large, so it is going to happen again." Big bucks are pouring into the marijuana industry as prospects improve that drug legalization will likely expand beyond Colorado and Washington state. Troy Dayton of the San Francisco-based ArcView Investment Group plans to raise $500,000 this year to invest in the marijuana trade. The 300-member National Cannabis Industry Association has hired longtime Republican Party operative Michael Correa as its full-time lobbyist. Correa had also worked for the Koch-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, a right-wing network of state legislators and corporations advocating voter suppression laws and opposing common-sense gun regulations and clean energy incentives. In a libertarian push to expand profitability, the National Cannabis Industry Association formed a broad coalition that included anti-tax activist Grover Norquist and progressive Democrats in a lobbying campaign to permit pot growers and retailers to deduct legitimate business expenses from their taxes. At the end of 2012, housing prices in central Los Angeles and other minority communities suddenly rose over 20%, locking out potential first-time homebuyers. The cause of the housing boom was new private equity and investor groups buying up thousands of foreclosed housing units in cities across the country hit hard by the housing crisis. Private equity groups are now among the largest owners of rental housing in the country. The largest rental investor company is Blackstone Group, which founded Invitation Homes that bought up thousands of units of low-cost single-family homes and converted them into rental units. Invitation Homes' management of these housing units has been the target of criticism from community activists. Last October, Blackstone sold $479 million in securitized bonds backed by rent payments from Invitation Homes. Institutional investors in these bonds include top Wall Street firms such as Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, and J.P. Morgan, some of the very same financial companies that sold securitized, bundled, subprime housing loans, which many economists have blamed for leading to the 2008 financial crash. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
In a public video conference on March 10th, former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden fielded questions from an audience at the South by Southwest Interactive Festival, an annual 10-day music, culture, and tech conference in Austin, Texas. Speaking through a video link from Russia, where he's been granted temporary political asylum, Snowden emphasized the need to secure the Internet to protect against the invasion of privacy by the U.S. and other governments around the world. He said, "They're setting fire to the future of the Internet, and the people who are in this room now, you guys, are all firefighters, and we need your help to fix this." These were Snowden's first remarks made directly to the American people since he left the country last June. Snowden, who revealed details of the U.S. government's previously unknown collection of domestic and overseas phone and internet communications, faces serious federal charges, including three felonies for espionage, theft, and conversion of government property. Snowden has become the eighth person to be charged by the Obama administration with crimes under the 1917 Espionage Act, more than double the number prosecuted by all previous U.S. presidents combined. Your reporter spoke with citizen activist, author, and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Here he discusses why he believes the government's dragnet surveillance and the massive collection of personal data threaten to undermine civil liberties, privacy rights, and democracy itself.
Well, first of all, the polls are moving in the direction of what Edward Snowden did. And that's because more and more of the American people are realizing that he tore away the curtain that covered some pretty bad, unconstitutional, illegal practices by the federal government. And the one that's gotten the most publicity is this 24-hour-a-day dragnet snooping by the NSA, scooping up and storing every telephone call, billions of emails, and doing a lot of it snooping on our allies like England and other countries overseas. That really rubs Americans wrong because, you know, if they're calling their doctor or talking about their teenager in a sensitive situation with a lawyer or a relative, you know, that Big Brother should not be recording those conversations. And the other disclosures by the NSA have really shown a reckless pattern of illegality that even President Obama wasn't fully aware of. By this sprawling giant security agency with billions of dollars all over the world, and doing so almost in a bungling manner, producing so much data they couldn't even handle 1% of it or process 1% of it. But the computerization of snooping is such, you know, they push buttons with algorithms and all this stuff flies into some sort of supposedly retrievable fashion. But what we have to realize is that by having the wrong and aggressive and illegal policies overseas, we are just creating more enemies. There never was an al-Qaeda in Iraq. It's killing 30 to 50 people a day now in Baghdad and elsewhere. There never was an al-Qaeda in Syria. Al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan and is now spread into 12 countries in East Africa, North Africa, Southeast Asia, and it has become a far more flexible and undetectable menace to people in those countries and indirectly to our own interests in those countries.
The Obama administration has over and over again said that the rationale for dragnet surveillance begun by the Bush administration is to keep the nation safe from terrorist attacks. We need minor reforms, they say, giving the responsibility of storing bulk phone data collected to the big telecom corporations was the Obama administration's latest move there in public diplomacy to try and get the public back on their side on this issue. What do you make of that?
First of all, dragnet enforcement has been known to be very efficient, inefficient rather. It leads to sloppy enforcement, to false charges, because dragnet enforcement does not reflect probable cause. If you read the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, you cannot spy on people, search and seizure was a phrase that was used, without probable cause. Well, if you have dragnet enforcement, you're bringing in the vast majority of people who are totally innocent. There is no probable cause. How can you snoop on every phone call in America by Americans and meet the standards of probable cause of the Fourth Amendment. So per se, Dragnet enforcement is a violation of the Fourth Amendment of our Constitution. Apart from being a really stupid policy, it's easy to push buttons, but you need the cooperation of people in law enforcement. Every police person knows that. And if you're snooping on the vast, vast, vast majority of people who are completely innocent, they're going to get upset. They're not going to feed back information. They're going to get very resentful. And if they don't display their resentment, they'll withdraw in cynicism, which is the worst result in a country that presumes to be a democracy.
What, in your mind, is the most effective thing people in the country can do right now to rein in government surveillance of the kind that a growing number of people are objecting to in terms of this massive data collection of our communications?
Well, some of them with pro bono lawyers can file more and more lawsuits in order to catch some good decisions by some judges and get that ball rolling in our judiciary. That's already beginning to happen. Others can focus on their senators and representatives and, you know, basically saying we're going to judge you on the basis of where you stand on this, especially if your senator representative is on the Armed Services Committee or the Intelligence Committees. And the third is they can have rallies. You know, government looks at one thing, and that is there a rumble coming from the people? And if there are rallies and marches, and those are focused on 535 members of Congress who put on their shoes every day like you and I and the president, that begins to send a message. Nobody can stop you from joining a march or signing a petition or going to a rally. It's very hard to get people out these days. I've often said half of democracy is showing up, and it's very difficult to get people to show up for rallies, marches, even for elections, never mind any other gathering, town meetings. If people are spending more and more time looking at screens held in their hands or in their living rooms, they're going to spend less and less time preventing the very problems that come to bear on them and their families.
That was citizen activist, author, and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader. His forthcoming book is titled Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. Find more commentary and analysis on NSA surveillance and the threat to personal liberty by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Robert Hillary King, known as one of the Angola Three, was imprisoned for 31 years, 29 in solitary confinement, spent in a 6-by-9-foot cell at Louisiana's Angola State Penitentiary for a crime he didn't commit. He was released in 2001 when the state overturned his conviction. King first served an almost 10-year sentence on a robbery conviction for a crime in which he also said he was innocent, but as a poor African-American teenager in the Deep South in the 1960s, he said that was par for the course. During his second time in prison, he joined the Black Panther Party and began organizing other inmates to demand basic improvements in prison conditions. When two other inmates, who were also Black Panther members, Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace, were wrongly charged in the murder of a prison guard, all three were placed in solitary confinement. Herman Wallace was released last October, terminally ill with liver cancer, and died 3 days later. Woodfox is currently serving his 41st year in solitary confinement. In 2008, King wrote his autobiography with Terry Coopers about his time in prison, titled From the Bottom of the Heap. During a talk on March 30th at New Haven Center Church on the Green, Robert King spoke about his years of incarceration, where he said it was his political convictions that helped him survive almost 3 decades in solitary confinement. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and brings us excerpts of King's talk.
In 1917, it was at that time that I became angry. I began to revisit my thoughts about the system. I looked at the system, and I just wondered why things were like they were. But at the time, again, I was not politically aware or politically active, for that matter. I was just a little rebel. A rebel with maybe a cause, but I did not have a conscience, a political consciousness. And I ended up getting 35 years, and I got angry. And I decided to do a thing that I felt necessary to do. I took the right that only a slave have. It dawned on me that I should take this right. The only right that a slave have was a right to rebel. You don't have a legal right if you're a slave. As the years went on, I want you to know that I kind of perfected this thought because I made the equation that just because something is legal does not mean that it's morally and wholly correct. I deduced and thought about slavery. Chattel slavery was something that was legal. But morally, it was wrong, and it wasn't until people began to see and spell out the immorality of slavery that people saw it as being reprehensible. And I saw the system that alleges the abolishment of slavery, that the 13th Amendment abolished slavery. And then when I read the words, I don't know, I'm going to say slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist on these shores unless one, a person who has been duly convicted of a crime, it dawned on me, wait a minute, something is wrong with that. There is an exception. To say that slavery was abolished is to err. It is the wrong thing. Slavery, for some people, was never abolished, and especially at this time, but now it hasn't been abolished for anybody because the prisoners fill with everybody now nearly, all colors, all genders, and so forth and so on. But basically, it was at this time I looked at that and I made that equation that slavery still existed. And that's the reason why I took the moral right to rebel. And I felt justified. Nobody got hurt. I made plans, and people were talking about, you know, having a lawyer to file a habeas corpus. Well, I filed a habeas escapus. And, yeah, I filed a habeas escapus. It wasn't a habeas corpus. It was a habeas escapus. I was successful for a minute, but they recaptured me, and it was short-lived, and I ended up, they actually charged me with aggravated escape, despite the fact that no one was, well, if getting out of prison aggravates your keeper, well, I aggravated them because I made it out. I got out of prison, and not only did I get out, I brought 12 others with me, and they were angry with me, but that is what I did. I brought 12 more people with me. Many of them was arrested that same night. However, I wasn't arrested on the same night. I was out a minute, about a week or so later, not much more than that. I was rearrested.
King then explained that after he was sent back to prison, he got to know some members of the Black Panther Party who were also incarcerated.
We began to communicate, and they began to say things to me that rang the bell. And I began to understand exactly what was going on. They asked me, did I know anything about the Black Panthers? Did I know anything about the 10-point platform? They began to tell me things like, you know, we have a 10-point platform, and this is what, you know, this is what we want. We want freedom. We want power to determine our destiny. And it dawned on me that I definitely wanted some freedom. You know, I took all that literally. The ideology of it was okay, but I wanted some freedom. I wanted some literal freedom out of prison. So that caught my attention. But they went on to point out other things about, you know, about the voting right, and we want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace, and as our major political objective, a United Nations supervised plebiscite to be held throughout the Black community, in which a subject would be allowed to participate for the purpose of determining the will of Black people as to their national destiny.
King's talk focused more on his early years in prison and his growing political awareness, and just a little on the 29 years he spent in solitary confinement before being released. In answer to a question about solitary, he said progress is being made.
We are making some headway because now many people, at one time, it was unheard of people talking about solitary confinement or lengthy sentences, having legislative hearing regarding solitary confinement and regarding prison. People are getting on board, and I think people now have begun to understand and see and to equate a prison with slavery, thing that the Black Panther Party said a long, long time ago. And even before the Black Panther Party said it, there were other people. Malcolm X said it, Elijah Muhammad. We could go on back to Frederick Douglass. The connection is there. Slavery is alive and is well, and it is in a form of prison.
That was Robert King, One of the Angola Three prisoners, who spent 29 years in solitary confinement, speaking at New Haven's Center Church on the Green. Learn more about King's prison experience and the campaign to free Albert Woodfox, the remaining Angola Three prisoner, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. It's no secret that money wields influence in the corporate world and in politics. And it's also true that in journalism, be it newspapers, television, or radio, that a media outlet's owner and their financial interests can determine what stories will be covered, which will be ignored, and the point of view their coverage conveys. Therefore, it was not surprising that when National Public Radio, NPR, started accepting corporate sponsorship from the American Natural Gas Alliance, those funds can influence how the radio network covered issues that the alliance cared about. According to the group Environmental Action, the American Natural Gas Alliance is a front group that promotes some of the worst energy polluters in America, including companies that employ the hydraulic fracturing or fracking method of extracting natural gas from underground shale formations. Fracking, although successful in producing more natural gas than was possible with older methods, has become controversial for the chemicals used in the process that have polluted water and air and contributes to climate change. In response to NPR's accepting corporate sponsorship funding from the American Natural Gas Alliance, which uses its underwriting airtime to disseminate misleading information about fracking across the U.S., Environmental Action launched a petition drive asking the network to stop taking fracking industry money that they believe negatively influences its reporting on the issue. Your reporter spoke with Drew Hudson, executive director of Environmental Action, who discusses his group's current campaign targeting NPR and recounts a December 18th meeting he and other activists had with NPR officials at the network's Washington headquarters.
So the American Natural Gas Alliance was a big sponsor of NPR programming. And they had been running these spots where they encourage people to just think about natural gas. And they would say these wonderful sounding stories about how natural gas was saving the family farm and helping people be cleaner and better. And in fact, the truth about fracking, as dozens of communities all over the country know, is much, much dirtier. Fracking has been linked to, polluted groundwater, increased global warming pollution, increased dependence on fossil fuels. And just in the last week, there's been some incidents in Ohio of fracking actually causing earthquakes. So there's all these litany of really terrible problems, and here was NPR, of all places, a sort of trusted news source, repeating on air these terrible lies about how clean and safe the drilling technology was. And a group of members of ours got together and said, hey, we're NPR members and donors. We're really kind of angry that they're saying all this misleading stuff about fracking. Will you help us put together a campaign to get the attention of National Public Radio? So that's where the petition campaign came from. As you say, over 45,000 people now have signed on, asking NPR to drop the sponsorship from the Natural Gas Alliance and stop repeating these misleading statements on air. We actually took the signatures down to NPR's national headquarters in D.C. in December, along with some fracking activists from Pennsylvania and other places, delivered them there and met with the ombudsman and the acting CEO of NPR. But to date, they haven't changed the policy. I mean, they've taken us seriously to some extent, but they haven't changed anything. So we're continuing to continue the campaign and put pressure on them to change their sponsorship and change these messages.
Give our audience, if you would, some examples of what kinds of coverage NPR has been doing in terms of favorable news reports about fracking and, I think, in your view, ignoring some of the negative science around fracking that people should know about.
Yeah, I mean, with NPR in particular, it's not so much a story of what they've been saying as what they haven't been saying. So when we went down and met with them in December, we brought several examples, and just in the couple of weeks since the holidays, there have been many more examples of where NPR will they're not saying anything that's untrue about fracking. They're just overlooking all the downsides, essentially. And in many cases, it's actually, an opportunity of the National Bureau really overlooking local stories. So we found a bunch of examples of where the Pennsylvania bureaus in particular had reported on local impacts of natural gas drilling, where they'd talked about some of the interviewed local people in communities who'd seen the impacts, of contaminated well water, of living next to fracking sites and seeing some of these air pollution impacts and things like that. The local stations were picking it up, and the national NPR affiliates, the shows like All Things Considered and Morning Edition that get millions more listeners than the local NPR station does in Pennsylvania, were just completely not showing that story. And one of the biggest stories we think that they really missed in the last year is this story about the cover-up, really, at the EPA. You know, the EPA had swept its own research under the rug. They had damning conclusions that clearly indicated that fracking was probably the source of water pollution in these three communities in Wyoming, Texas, and Pennsylvania. And the Pennsylvania Bureau picked up the story when it turned out that thanks to whistleblowers in the Philadelphia office of the EPA, they leaked their own research, which they had been told not to share with the press. They gave it to reporters at ProPublica and at the LA Times and other places, and that formed bedrock of really being able to create a sort of smoking gun to show that fracking really was having these dramatic impacts on groundwater and that the EPA had known about it. And we found out later from subsequent reporting that, you know, the pressure to cover up that research probably came from very high up in both the White House and in Congress. And NPR was completely silent on that story, even as, you know, people from Dimmick, Pennsylvania were driving across the state to Philadelphia to deliver jugs of contaminated drinking water and stand in solidarity with the whistleblowers in their state at the EPA office. The local stations were picking up and the national stations were completely covering it up. And that was just one example of where we thought that NPR was really missing the story despite all the clear reasons they should pick it up. It was their local bureaus doing the reporting. Very clearly an interesting story would impact a number of communities around the country and has to do with a huge national energy boom. I mean, this fracking is really the new gold rush going on in America. There are new wellheads opening every day. Fracking companies are out pushing communities from coast to coast to adopt this new drilling technology with very little disclosure and very little discussion of the real risks to the environment and to human health. And it's going to be up to news sources to tell the truth because clearly the frackers aren't going to do it. And so far, at least, the administration and Congress have not been willing to adopt rules and regulations that would compel them to tell the truth about their impacts.
That was Drew Hudson, Executive Director of Environmental Action. For more information on the group's NPR Don't Even Think About It campaign, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Heal and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.